ॐ भद्रं कर्णेभिः श्रुणुयाम देवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षभिर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैः तुष्टुवांसस्तनूभिः व्यसेम देवहिदं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्ताक्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। ओ आल्माइटी लॉर्ड, मे वी हियर विद अवर इयर्स व्हाट इज ऑस्पिशियस, मे वी सी विद अवर आईज व्हाट इज ऑस्पिशियस, मे वी व्हाइल ऑफरिंग अवर प्रेज टू गॉड विद अवर बॉडी स्ट्रॉंग अप लिम्स एंजॉय द लाइफ विच द ऑलमाइटी हैज प्लीज्ड टू ग्रांट अस। मे इंद्रा ऑफ ग्रेट फेम बी well disposed to us. May the all-knowing Pusha be propitious to all of us. May Garuda, the vanquisher of all miseries, be well pleased with us. May Brihaspati grant us all prosperity. Om peace, peace, peace. Now in this Mandukya Kariga text, we have been elaborately discussing the 26th verse of the third chapter, which reveals one particular aspect of Vedanta philosophy. As I already explained earlier, according to Vedanta, the absolute reality is one, that is immanent in all being, it is omnipresent, it is transcendental, it is impersonal, it is beyond words, beyond description, beyond definition, and it is the all pervading consciousness. Now, and again in the 26th verse, one point was made by the author. एष नीति नीतीति व्याख्यातं निन्नुदे यतः सर्वमग्राह्य भावेन हेतुनाजं प्रकाशते। इट्स अ फेमस वर्स। शैल एक्सप्लेन, ऑलरेडी एक्सप्लेन्ड, द सेंट्रल पॉइंट इज दिस, दिस रियलिटी विच इज बियॉन्ड डिस्क्रिप्शन, बियॉन्ड वर्ड्स एंड बियॉन्ड सेंसरी कॉम्प्रिहेंशन। नाउ हाउ डू वी अंडरस्टैंड इट? Vedanta says this reality, though it cannot be defined or perceived through the five senses, can be experienced within. And this is intuitive experience, not sensory experience. Anything that you perceive in the external world, we perceive with any of the five senses or mind. We see things with mind and eyes. We hear things with mind and ears. We come to know of certain things by touch. When we use our sense of touch, that's one of the senses, and mind. If mind is absent, there will be no comprehension. And if any of the senses are absent, then also there will be no comprehension. So, whatever we know in this world, we know only through objectification of the objects. Objectification means the object of knowledge becomes the object and we become the subject. We use our mind and the senses of perception to know different things. Vedanta says the absolute reality is not something that could be perceived through objectification, but it can be perceived in a much more intimate manner as our own inner reality. In fact, the highest experience is beyond words. Even in the sensory world, you find, even in the sensory world, even at the level of human emotions, at the highest level, it is beyond words. Even a mother mother's affection for her little child cannot be defined. It's a human emotion, the highest level. Normally we express in words things which are not absolute, relative. So we find even human emotions cannot be really explained. And most of what we express or describe are based on certain inner experience. We say sugar is sweet, but there is an experience behind. In fact, the experience of sweetness of sugar cannot be defined. If you explain to a person the sweetness of sugar, he will understand it only if he has himself experienced sweetness of something else. That's the view of Sri Ramakrishna, the great teacher. He says, any real experience can be only experienced, cannot be expressed in words or defined. Now, in the 26th verse, the great philosopher Gaudapada made a very important point. This absolute reality cannot be expressed in words. And if we go on negating, well, I am not this body, I am something beyond this body, I am not the eyes with which I see the vehicles moving in the streets, I am something beyond that, I am not even the mind, because mind also cannot be an absolute reality. You find mind also changes. Mind is a wavering phenomenon. Anything that's subject to change or wavering cannot be absolute. Intellect also. There is variation with regard to intellectual powers. So I am not this sensory objects, nor the senses, nor the mind, nor the intellect. Then who am I? Now, there is no description. Beyond intellect, beyond words, who am I? Now, after negating, after this process of negation, I am not the senses, because I am beyond that. If you see, well, I am perceiving an elephant, certainly, I am something who is the actor involved in the act of perceiving an object. But actually my eyes are seeing, you can say. In that case, you know, we are different from the eyes. My eyes in a possessive case. So which means the eyes and myself are different. Or you say, I feel hungry or I feel angry, whatever it may be. So my mind is getting tired. So there you find mind and the person who is getting tired is different. If you say, I am angry, well, because mind is getting angry. The mind and the personality get identified. But if you say, my mind is getting tired, means the mind is different, I am different. So who am this I? So if you go on denying through this negative process, if you go on denying, well, I am not the senses, I am not the eyes, I am not the mind or intellect, who am I? Then you reach a point where there is nothing else to be negated. The negator cannot negate himself or herself. Who am I? That is a mysterious phenomenon. So, in this 26th verse, Gaudapada says, after negating all this, we reach a point where we cannot actually negate anything else. In fact, this is a very famous verse which is based on another text where Athada Adeso Neti Neti. There is a famous statement in there. There is a statement in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad which says, well, the instruction is not this, not this. Means not, I'm not this body, I'm not the mind, I'm not the intellect. Who am I experience, who am I who experiences this blissfulness which we cannot really define or explain? When we reach the highest mystical spiritual experience, it is beyond words. So Vedanta says it is beyond the epistemological tools of knowing, perception, direct perception, inference, verbal testimony, comparison, presumption, and negation, absence. These are the six tools which are accepted in Vedanta philosophy. Aristotle accepts three tools, of course. Now, Vedanta goes beyond. Vedanta says, well, there are things that you perceive with the eyes or the ears and mind, direct perception. Then when you infer, but inference is always based upon a direct perception earlier. Because Pratyaksha is direct perception, Anumana is inference. You cannot infer something unless you have the background of direct perception. And then verbal testimony is something that we cannot imagine or see in front of us. We get that information from a book, verbal testimony, the Bible, the Gita, whatever may be. And then comparison, we see an object, we don't know what it is, but it somehow resembles another object that you have seen sometime in the past. So through comparison, we come to know we come to get some understanding of what the object is in front of us. So comparison. Presumption means, that's an important tool, epistemological tool in Vedantic epistemology. Something very funny, if you find a man or woman who are maybe, she or he doesn't eat anything during daytime, but he's absolutely healthy, strong, not because of obesity or any chronic health problem, perfectly all right, which means she must be eating at night. So you come to some kind of, it is somewhat related to inference, but not real inference. This is the fifth tool of perception, or tool of epistemology in Vedanta, presumption. Arthapatti means you come to infer, not real inference, somewhat an inference which is forced upon you. You cannot explain it through any other tool of knowledge, theory of knowledge. There is no epistemological tool which can explain this. So we infer, we come to some understanding. And then the absence is also knowledge, because when you go there expecting something, when you find it is not there, you get the knowledge that it doesn't exist there. So that's also a kind of knowledge. Now, Gaudapada says this Atman, this Supreme Consciousness can never be comprehended through any of these tools of epistemology. And Gaudapada also says it is the only absolute reality. Absolute reality means something which always exists without any change in the past, in the present, and in the future, which is perceived without any change. It remains the same. Anything which is subject to change should be relative. This is not subject to change, it is changeless, so it is eternal, everlasting. And Gaudapada says that it cannot be comprehended through any of the accepted tools of knowledge. You cannot see it, you cannot hear it, you cannot understand it through inference. And then again says, another important thing, verbal testimony, that is an important tool here. Books cannot reveal the absolute truth. That is something very interesting. In fact, Vedanta is the only philosophy which tells you that the supreme truth is not in a book. In fact, in popular monotheistic Hinduism and all Abrahamic religions, in all the well-known established religious canons, there is a statement, well, this is the truth. This is revealed to somebody, or this is directly coming from God. Vedanta says no word can be the supreme truth. The experience that a word implies is the supreme truth. That's a very important point. So all the Upanishads, all the Gita, all the scriptures will teach you so many ideas about the supreme reality. But all these books tell you, well, this becomes a real knowledge only when you get this experience. So there is no religion unless you realize God. See, God is a word for somebody who thinks I believe in God. Just I believe in socialism or I believe in Kant or Hegel. No, very different. But true belief, rather, true religion is spirituality, and that is based on experience. And this experience is beyond epistemology, beyond the tools of knowledge, beyond tools of theory of knowledge. It is intuitive, inner experience. So experience is the only criterion for true spiritual knowledge. All the books are necessary. All the books are extremely helpful. They are very necessary. They are very helpful. But they point out towards a higher level. These words, these great philosophical spiritual books tell us that we cannot reveal the supreme truth. The supreme truth is our own intuitive experience. These books will guide you. They will help you. They will tell you what are wrong ideas which you should avoid, and what are the correct ideas which may help you, which may lead you to the supreme experience. In fact, that is one important aspect of Vedanta philosophy. The ultimate criterion of knowledge is experience and not conviction or belief. Now, if these ideas are put forward, somebody may ask the question, in that case, this Advaitic ideal, Atman or Brahman, is non-existent. It cannot be perceived, it cannot be defined, it cannot be seen, and no books can reveal it. In that case, what is it? I told you, Vedanta says it is intuitive inner experience. But that is only the conviction, the conclusion. Before reaching the conclusion, there are some discussions. So in the 27th verse and in the 28th verse, there are some discussions involved. The 27, 28, 29th verses. So some other philosophers ask the question, if the true experience is beyond definition and beyond words and beyond comprehension, then it should be non-existent. That's the idea behind it. Now, as a reply to this, Gaudapada answers in the 27th verse, Satohi mayaya janma yujyade natu tattvadaha tattvado jayade yasya jatam tasya hi jayate. This is the 27th verse. The prose order is this. Sataha mayaya janma yujyate tattvadaha janma natu yujyate yasya tattvadaha jayade tasya jatam hi jayate. This idea behind. So you have to remember many of the ideas already described. Vedanta says, Gaudapada says, that Atman is the only reality, and that reality is eternal. This world as we experience, the world in which we live, the world of which we are a part, is only a relative phenomenon. This empirical world is only a relative existence, not an absolute reality, because it goes on changing. Everything in this world is subject to change. So it cannot be the absolute reality. Atman or Brahman, the consciousness, is the only absolute everlasting reality. This is the conclusion. Now, what about the world? So Gaudapada says, the idea that this world as a real entity comes out of the supreme consciousness, the Atman, which is the absolute reality, cannot be accepted. Because if Atman of consciousness is the only reality, how can this world be really an existent phenomenon? It cannot be. So, if at all you explain that the world comes into existence, that coming to existence is only a relative phenomenon, not real. So, maya means through relative. If at all you accept the origin of this universe from this all-pervading, eternal, absolute Brahman, then the origin of the universe cannot be real origin, or it cannot be really coming into existence. Because if it really comes into existence, there should be two entities, two realities in the world. Atman is one thing and the world is another thing. There should be two entities. But Vedanta says Atman is the only absolute reality. Then what about this world? The world comes into existence only in a relative sense. This was already explained in the previous verses in the light of the famous illustration. You have to again remember the famous Vedantic illustration. You have to think of a semi-dark room which is not properly lit. There is an object lying on the floor. It is actually a piece of rock, somewhat curved in shape. Now, four people entering the room may look at this rope and may have four different perceptions. One person thinks that this object is a snake because he has seen a snake the previous day somewhere, and this closely resembles that. Another person may think it is a piece of wood. It is a piece of stick, curved stick. Another person may think it's a crack on the floor. If there is not enough light, if there's a curved crack on the floor, then a piece of rope may be mistaken for a crack on the floor. Bhuchidra in Sanskrit is called. So sarpa is snake, danda is stick, bhuchidra is a crack on the floor. Another person may think, well, it is a thin stream of light. Maybe if there are 100 people in the room, 100 people will have 100 different perceptions and ideas. Because they do not know it is a piece of rock, because there is not enough light. Now, when you bring light, what really happens? The light doesn't produce the rock. The light reveals the fact to the onlookers that it is a piece of rock. The fact that this is a piece of rope is not the result of light that is brought. The light's function is limited to removing darkness. And once darkness is removed, our comprehension becomes clear. Now the question arises, what about the ontological status of these objects which people had in mind when they looked at the piece of rope? The person who thought it's a snake. What is the status of the snake? It is only snake idea, not the real snake. The snake is not completely non-existent because there could be snakes in the zoo or maybe in the forest or in the bush, which this person has seen and he remembers. So he superimposes that snake on the piece of rope. So the snake is not absolutely non-existent. It exists somewhere. It is not totally non-existent. The person will not mistake the piece of rope for a truck. He mistakes the piece of rope only for something which is similar to the rope and which he has seen, which he remembers. So the snake idea that the person has got in his mind is superimposed upon the rope, and the rope idea is non-existent because there is not enough light. So the ontological status of the snake is relative. Not absolute, not absolutely existent, because it is really not a snake, it is a rope only. But it is not absolutely non-existent because the snake is somewhere. So what happens? Its status is relative. So also similarly, the person who mistook the rope for a curved stick, what's the ontological status of the stick? Or the thin stream of light? Or anything. Maybe if 1,000 people have seen this piece of rope in the semi-dark room, there could be 1,000 misunderstandings, misconceptions. So what is the ontological status of these misunderstandings, the objects which they have superimposed upon the real object? Relative. So also this world. The world is not absolutely non-existent. An absolutely non-existent world we will not perceive. The world is not absolutely existent. Why? something which is absolutely existent should not be subject to change. It should remain the same, the past and the present and future. The world will continue to exist maybe 13 million years, whatever maybe. Maybe several hundreds of thousands of years, maybe the age of this universe. And before that, this universe as we see it did not exist. And after that, the universe will not exist the way it is existing now in front of us. So what does it mean? Existence is relative. The world is relative. The universe is relative. So also our body. Maybe 100 years. So maybe an insect, few minutes. A bacteria, maybe seconds, whatever. So Vedanta says there is only one reality in this world. And that is beyond description, beyond comprehension, beyond epistemological tools. Now, Gaudapada in the 27th verse says, if at all you believe that this world really comes into existence and exists as a separate entity, you are wrong. But if you believe it comes into existence in a relative sense and exists in a relative sense, it is you are right. So Mayaya means through the prism of time, space and causation. That is Maya. Maya means nothing but this anything which is confined to time, space and causation. This triple dimension, that is Maya. And in that sense, the world is real. Beyond that, the world has no existence. This is the idea behind. Just a snake idea comes into existence because the person could not see it's a piece of rope. And in fact, he may have run to bring a stick to remove this so-called snake. Even while running, he may have broken his neck also. All these things could happen. So, he has broken his neck, he has gone to the hospital all because it's all illusion. Illusion means all based on or relative, that's all. The snake existed only in the relative plane, not the real sense of the term. So Gaudapada says, if at all you believe the world comes into existence, really speaking, you are wrong. But if at all it comes into existence, it is only in a relative sense. That is Mayaya Natu Sattva Tattvadaha. Tattvadaha means not in reality, not actually. Paramarthadaha, that's the Sanskrit. Now, there are a number of theories with regard to creation. In Indian philosophy, theistic philosophy and also atheistic systems and also in many theological streams of Western thought. But mostly Abrahamic religions conceive the world in terms of something which is created by God with a definite purpose, with a definite scheme. That's how it is perceived. That's true also, that's true in some of the monotheistic, traditional, popular Hindu philosophical systems, but not in Advaita Vedanta of Shankaracharya. That's the idea behind. Now, in the 28th verse, another idea is put forward. So, in the 27th verse, Gaudapada said that this absolute reality is all-pervading, immanent, transcendental, changeless, eternal, remaining the same, the past, present and future, and so on. And from that absolute reality, the world comes into existence only in a relative sense, means not in the absolute sense. Well, you think of different golden ornaments and gold. The gold really doesn't become the ornament. What happens when the goldsmith superimposes certain shapes and sizes and some his own artistic skill on the gold appears to have become different ornaments. Even when you are wearing a golden necklace, it is ontologically not different from the gold, pure gold that is extracted from the earth. It's not very different. In an ontological sense, it is not different. Only in relative sense, it's different because shape, size, form, artistry, work, skills of an efficient artisan, all these are involved in the golden ornament. Otherwise, in an ontological sense, it is not very different. It is not at all different from the gold that is extracted from earth. Similarly, all the name and form are only relative. They are not eternal. That's the idea behind. In the 28th verse, Gaudapada takes up another set of argument. This time, he has in mind certain people, certain philosophers, who believe that everything in this world comes out of something which is essentially non-existent. That is his view. In a way, this is a refutation of the Shunyavada, because according to Shunyavada, according to those who hold the doctrine of emptiness, doctrine of voidness, the absolute reality is voidness or emptiness. From that, the whole universe comes into existence. How can this universe come into existence from something which is essentially non-existent? If there is nothing on the floor, then you won't perceive a snake. There should be a piece of rope which resembles a snake. Then only the snake idea will come to your mind and you will mistake the rope for the snake. Otherwise not. So there should be some object to begin with. There should be an ontological entity, and you superimpose your own ideas on that entity. You cannot superimpose anything on emptiness, on something which is essentially non-existent. We cannot even imagine in total vacuum. Even the poetical fancies, fantasies, imaginations of poets, mystics, philosophers, all these imaginations and ideas will have the background of something which is real. Because we can never imagine or think or conceive of anything in this universe in total vacuum. So, Gaudapada, that's a point which Gaudapada makes here.
Asato mayaya janma tattudo naiva yujyade vantya putro na tattvena mayaya vapi jayate.
That's the idea behind it. Now, in the earlier verse, the 27th verse, Gaudapada said, from the absolute reality, this relative universe actually cannot come into existence, only in a relative sense. Now he says, even in a relative sense, this world cannot come into existence from something which is essentially non-existent. If there is no piece of rope, if there is nothing on the floor, then you will not mistake some total voidness for something. To superimpose something, you need a substratum. A substratum you need. On a substratum, you superimpose something which is really speaking, non-existent, but which exists in your imagination, and a snake idea, etc. So he says, from something which is totally non-existent, nothing can come into existence. The world cannot come into existence, even in a relative sense, or in the absolute sense. That means the voidness, total voidness or shunya, can never be the substratum for this universe. According to the Mahayana school of Buddhist, as I said earlier, there are two fundamental schools of idealism. The Shunyavada, the doctrine of emptiness, and the doctrine of voidness, and the doctrine of subjective idealism. These are two schools of Buddhist idealism. According to both these schools, the external world doesn't exist. That's why they call idealists. Vijnanavada is subjective idealism. Shunyavada is a is a negation of not only the objective world but also the subject. Vedanta accepts a witness, all-knowing subject. Vedanta says the external objects are relative. They are not totally non-existent. Universe, you cannot say the world doesn't exist at all. We can say the world will not exist in the same manner for eternity. Because maybe after some trillions of years, the universe will be something else. So the universe that you see in front of us is not totally non-existent. But it is not totally existent. It's not absolute existence. To be absolutely existent, it should remain the same in the past, in the present, and future without any change. And if it is totally non-existent, then we will not even experience it at any time. Even in a relative plane, even as an illusion, we will not experience it. That's the idea. Because even to experience it as an illusion, you should have some idea in mind. And this idea cannot exist without a corresponding relative existence, the external world. So the world cannot be absolutely non-existent or absolutely existent. That's a Vedantic view. But the two schools of Buddhist idealists, the Shunyavada and the Vijnanavada, the doctrine of emptiness and the subjective idealism, they assert that the world, the external world, is totally non-existent. That's the idea behind. And Shunyavada believes that subject also is non-existent. So that's, they're called Asatvadins, those who believe in non-existence as the fundamental category, philosophical category. Here Gaudapada says, from something which is totally non-existent, this world can never come into existence. Then he gives a very well-known illustration. There are a few illustrations in Vedantic texts which are used to drive home the idea that something which is totally non-existent can never be experienced or imagined or conceived of. One is the son of a barren woman, Pandhya Putraha means, or the horn of a hare. These ideas, even as ideas, they cannot be possible. You cannot even imagine them as an idea. So Gaudapada says it is absolutely impossible for this relative universe to come out of something which is totally non-existent, as asserted by the followers of Buddhist idealism, is called Shunyavada, or the doctrine of emptiness. Now, the question arises, what is the Vedantic view? Vedanta says, it's a very important point. According to Vedanta, the world exists as the magic of a magician. The famous statement I already dealt with that subject earlier in the same text. Gaudapada, of course, Gaudapada doesn't go that far. It is the great exponent of Advaita, Shankaracharya, who in his commentary makes this point clear. The Advaitic view of the world is that world is a play. You find so much of inconsistency in this world. And behind the inconsistencies, you will find some kind of orderliness. Ultimately, we find the world is totally incomprehensible. But this orderliness is only on the surface. We can never really predict anything that is going to happen. We can predict within a short span of time, maybe for thousands of years. That is also a short span of time in contrast to the total age of the universe. So universe also, millions of galaxies are coming and going. So how do you think of the age of this endless vastness of existence? Impossible. If you go on counting the number of grains on the desert, there will be no end. but you can take one grain and analyze and then come to a conclusion. The whole desert consists of an infinite number of the same type of grains, which is what is called, which we call the desert. So Gaudapada says the creation can only be explained as a sport, as a play. Now, you know, play, something like a hobby. There is not a definite purpose behind a hobby. If you think seriously and deliberate for a long time and plan, then you will not be able to enjoy the play. It will not become a sport or a hobby or a play. So why do you play means there is no answer. So the world is totally incomprehensible. But it can be properly comprehended as relativity. And relativity is essentially incomprehensible because relativity is within time, space and causation. So within these three dimensions, you can predict. But that area, the realm of predictability is limited. Beyond that, it is unpredictable. So how do you relate creation with creator? If you believe that the world, God created this world on a particular day with a definite purpose, you have to imagine that God has some idea, some purpose, something to, if he deliberates and creates his world as a well planned scheme, as a result of long planning and contemplation, then you have to admit that God is imperfect because he is in need of doing something, this world. He has to create this world. So you are asserting that God is imperfect, which is totally opposed to logic. And even in case you believe that this world is a creation of God, how do you reconcile the idea of an all-merciful creator God and this world which is actually full of miseries and uncertainties? So how do you explain it? So Vedantic answer is, creation can only be understood as a play or a sport. That's the idea behind. In the most obtuse Vedantic book, Brahma Sutra Lokavattu Leela Kaivalyam, it is just a play. I shall just read out one important portion from Shankaracharya's commentary, which is a celebrated description of what the world is like. He says, he gives the example, a magician comes to a king's court and he throws up a rope into the sky, the old ancient Indian rope magic. And then, this is a well-known analogy, you find some of these incidents are mentioned in the travelogues of Marco Polo and Alberuni. Marco Polo is an Italian traveler who visited India in the 12th century. Alberuni came little earlier. Now, they have recorded this Indian rope trick. A magician comes, we don't know whether it's real or not, it's a different matter. Magician comes, he throws up a rope and then he climbs to the sky. And after some time, dead bodies, broken skulls, limbs all fall on the ground. He says, there is a battle going on with the demons and gods. So gods have requested me to go and help them in the battle against the demons. So that's how what he claims. Pure magic in ancient times is mentioned in some of the mythological books. And after some time, dead bodies, all these things fall to the ground. People are deceived. But then, after some time, everything has vanished. Then people understand it's only magic. Now, Shankaracharya says, here The magic is unreal, but magician is real. So magic is only an illusion created by the magician. And so long as the play is going on, the magic show is going on, maybe for a few minutes, maybe for a few hours, people, the onlookers, may believe it is real. Before that, before the magic show began, they did not believe. And after it is over, then also they did not believe, because it is only magic, they understand. But the magician is the reality. Similarly, rope is the reality, the snake is unreal. Behind this relative universe, the empirical phenomenal universe, which is only relative existence, behind and as its foundation, there is a substratum which is real, that is Brahman or Atman. So, Nahi Mayavinam Sutram Akashe Nikshipya Tena Sayudham Aruhya Chakshurgocharata Matitya Yudhena Khandasachinnam Paditam Punaruthidam Chapashyadam Takkrata Mayadi Sadattu Chintayam Aduro Bhavati. This idea about somebody who watches the whole show and who has seen this magic earlier. Maybe the magician's son, maybe one of his companions following him, assisting the whole show. He may not believe. But people who see this for the first time may believe that the world is real. Similarly, a spiritually enlightened soul, a mystical saint who had gone beyond relative universe, may live in this world and for all practical purposes may look like any of us. But for him or for her, this world is only a relative entity. The world doesn't shock him or shock her. The world with all the miseries, all the anxieties and uncertainties did not rattle them, these great saints and mystics. Because they know this is a magic show. And they know that if there is a magic show going on, there should be magicians standing somewhere who is actually not involved. Magician is not actually involved in the magic. Only the onlookers are involved. For the magician, it is a daily play going on. He travels from country to country playing this rope trick in different courts for the enjoyment, appreciation of the courtiers. Similarly, for a spiritually enlightened person, this world, this universe, this created universe is real only in a relative sense. So it is relativity. So anything which is within time, space and causation is relative, but it has no real ontological status. Now, the great Sri Ramakrishna, the teacher of Swami Vivekananda, makes a point. He says, a king, or rather he's an actor, a rich man, a super rich actor who plays the role of a beggar, or a king who plays the role of a beggar, he may get Oscar award. In fact, he may look more beggarly, more wretched looking, and much more miserable than a professional beggar in the streets. He may get award also. But before he starts his play, and after the play, after the acting, he goes and stays in a 5-star hotel. So even when he's playing this role of a beggar, he's not really miserable, though his face may look more miserable than professional beggars. Similarly, a spiritually enlightened person may live in this world, may, for all practical purposes, may appear to be part of this worldly existence, like part of any of us. But still at heart, he or she is not affected by the problems of the world. May live in the world, but still not part of this world. Worldliness may not enter his mind, though he may live in this world. As Sri Ramakrishna said this very aptly. No? When you are traveling by boat in a river, water should not enter the boat. Boat may capsize. It may cause an accident. The boat should be on the surface of the water. Similarly, one can live in this world without being worldly minded. One can live in this world without worldliness entering our life. That's the idea, the deeper message of this important verse. And Gaudapada was prompted to give all these arguments because some people may argue that this universe, that this, if the universe is only relative and the absolute reality is beyond comprehension by mind or intellect and senses, then that absolute reality can be totally unreal. You find that question being asked by many modern thinkers. If God is a transcendental reality who cannot be perceived, who cannot be explained, who has no role in our daily life, then it should be just an idea, just an illusion, just an imagination. And if God is actually a transcendental person who creates this world with the origin of transcendental origin of morality, who supervises this world, then how do you explain the incompatibility of an all-merciful God and a miserable world? Why should there be so many problems in this world? Both these questions are put forward by thinkers. If the absolute reality of God is beyond comprehension, it should be unreal. And if it is a very, very empirical entity who creates this world and who is very merciful, who is interested in the welfare of his creation, the human beings, then why should there be so much of misery in this world? So, that's why there is an objection raised by the opposite thinkers. Tatra edasya agrahimeva ched asadeva atmatattvamiti. That's the idea behind. See, if the Atman is incomprehensible, then it should be something of like an imagination. It cannot be an existent reality. It should be non-existent. But Vedanta says, this Atman is the only real existence. The Atman or consciousness is the only absolute reality in this world. Everything else is real only in a relative sense. In other words, they are not absolutely real. It may be incomprehensible in an empirical sense, in the sense that we cannot understand the reality, Atman, by the mind or intellect of the senses. But it is our own true nature. It is our own immanent nature. And its reality can be perceived at the inner experience level. It can be experienced. So Vedanta uses a very interesting term. It's Sakshat Aparokshat Brahman. This Atman, this Brahman is our own true nature, in our own reality, true nature. So it is closest to us. It is incomprehensible by the senses and mind. So it's not far away, but it's our own true nature. And every spiritual effort is directed at realizing this truth. So every spiritual sadhana, spiritual effort is an inward spiritual journey to self-discover, to rediscover our true nature. In spiritual life, we are not just getting a new knowledge, we are not perceiving a new truth. What we are doing is, we are rediscovering our true nature. By removing all wrong notions, we are rediscovering our true nature. When we understand that this Atman, this consciousness, is the immanent reality within the whole creation, it is also the all-pervading reality, it's also the transcendental reality. Now we'll come to, if you have got anything to ask, we have got 5 minutes, otherwise we'll conclude. Anybody who would like to?
Anything, any idea that I explained this time? It's not clear, you can ask. Purusha. Yes. Yes. Ishvara or God as the one who creates this world is the highest idea that we can have so long as we believe this world is real. As I said earlier, we have to start from where we stand. This is the highest spiritual ideal. So long as we believe this world is real, we also have to accept our body is real, mind is real, intellect is real. And then we have to accept Ishvara as the highest idea of God that we can conceive of. The moment we transcend, we go beyond the realm of world consciousness, body consciousness, then we also go beyond the realm of Ishvara, the creator God aspect. Then this Atman is Atman becomes a matter of experience. So to begin with, we have to accept the world as a relative reality, and our mind and intellect, our senses or actions are all real, and then work for our own spiritual good and for the good of the world. These are the words of the great Advaita teacher Shankaracharya himself. Shankaracharya makes a very interesting statement in the Karika. There he says, you know, so long as we are dreaming, dream objects are real for us. We understand that dream objects are dream objects only when we come out of dream. When within dream, dream objects are the only reality. Similarly, when we are living in this world and when we have not fully gone beyond body consciousness, we have to accept the world is real. And then we have to think of an almighty, all-merciful God who has created this world and practice spiritual sadhana, spiritual practice for our own purification. And the best practice is to convert all karma action into karma yoga. All action, all karma can be converted into karma yoga. It means looking upon every act, physical, intellectual, any kind, whatever we do, it should be converted into worship. Every act is an act of offering a defeat of Almighty God. If this is done sincerely, then automatically we'll graduate to the next level of evolution. Then we'll go beyond this world. So Advaita is not a rejection of empirical world or Ishvara or anything. Advaita goes beyond. When you go beyond, you don't contradict. So when you reach the master's class, you don't contradict, you don't reject what you have learned in the kindergarten. The same alphabet you use, the same arithmetic figures you use, but you reach a higher level of understanding. This doesn't go contrary to that. But the word Purusha is different. Purusha, in fact, is explained as the immanent universal consciousness itself. Because the definition Puri Shetayidi Purusha. Puri means, Pura means a temple or a city. So who is Purusha? Purusha is that immanent reality that exists in all of us. And that reality is the all-pervading omnipresent reality. So Purusha is, in fact, it is a synonym for Atman in the Purusha Sukta and other books you find. Sometimes it is used as a synonym of God also, created God also. So it depends upon the context. Yes. In fact, Shiva is the highest concept of Ishvara for those who believe, those who belong to that particular sect of believers. And those who believe in, those who belong to the Vaishnava tradition, the Vishnu or Krishna is the highest. Those who belong to Shakta tradition, Shakti is the highest. Both are the same. For each group, that particular ideal is the highest monotheistic ideal of absolute reality. But when they reach the highest peak of this monotheistic worship, accepting God with name and form, when they reach the supreme, the peak of that experience, then they realize the impersonal dimension also. It is it, at that level they go beyond it. That's right. There is no contradiction. Contradiction exists only at the philosophical doctrinal level. At a spiritual experience level, when we enter the field of experience, all contradictions are reconciled. That's it. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.